listening to The Realist Report. And now your host, John Friend.
All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. The website is therealistreport.com, where you can find an extensive archive of these podcasts as well as other radio programs I've participated in. You can also find all of my blog posts and recent articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded on the right-hand side of the website, and lots of other useful links and information. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also write for The Barnes Review, the bi-monthly history magazine associated with American Free Press. I encourage listeners to subscribe to both publications. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all of the details. Okay, with that said, let me introduce my special guest this evening. Carolyn Yeager is joining us once again. Carolyn, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, John. It's nice to be here.
Yes, glad that you could join me. And I do apologize for all of the rescheduling that I've had to do recently trying to get this going. Thank you for bearing with me. And today we wanted to talk about a couple subjects in particular. And I thought the best way to do it would be to start off by talking about a book that you recently read by Jürgen Graf. And the title is White World Awake, Stopping the Planned Extermination of Our Volk. And this was a book, I believe it was actually published by the Barnes Review.
Yes, it is.
And from what I understand, I haven't read the book. I do remember when it was first released, which was, as I mentioned, pretty recently. I'm looking at the description page here over on the Barnes Review where you can actually purchase the book, which I'll talk about in just a second. But I wanted to begin by having you kind of talk about Jürgen Graf. I'm not too familiar with this author and with this man. I know he's a revisionist, and you're much more familiar with him. So could you first start off by telling listeners a little bit about the author before we jump into the actual book?
Oh, okay. Jürgen Graf is a fantastic human being. In fact, in my opinion, he's dedicated his life to helping to reveal and publicize the truth, as he sees it, of course. He's kind of was a favorite of mine among the revisionists for a long time. Whatever he wrote, I always related to a lot, and I always liked very much. He's not the most important revisionist, I guess, as far as the work that he's done, but he's been involved in that most important work, and he just has a great way of writing. So this is a very interesting book. It's big, you know, it's long. There's a lot in it. It's well written, as he writes everything well. And his heart and his belief really comes through. And he's paid a big price for this, devotion to, discovering and, publicizing the truth. Well, he lost his job. He had a good job as a teacher. He's a brilliant man. And he's the one who knows, about 20 languages. Really, you know, I mean, I guess the more languages that you learn, the easier it is to learn more. So there's that. But if you've never really, don't really know even one really well, it seems like quite an achievement. And so he's been great in translating from other languages. And of course, he's native German speaker. He's from Switzerland. He grew up in Switzerland. And I learned in this book that his father, the introduction to the book is his telling how he came about, you know, how he developed and how he came awake to things, and goes all the way through his life till now. And currently he lives in Russia. He's been living in Russia for a long time. And the reason he's there, otherwise he'd be back in Switzerland or in Germany. I don't think he'd want to be in Germany though, but you know, he wouldn't have gone away. But while he was in Switzerland, he got into revisionism. He tells all about that in the introduction. It's really interesting. It's my favorite chapter of the book, actually. Although, you know, because I like reading about people's journeys.
Yeah, it's always very interesting and very revealing. And that's kind of the intro of it. He kind of explains his path to awakening and coming to the conclusions that he's come to.
Right. And what happened to him was that when he got into revisionism, he lost his job, but he was still doing all right. And he was working with all the revisionists and writing and got involved with Carlo Mantegna. And eventually he got in trouble with the Swiss authorities and they they put him on trial, and he went to trial, and he was convicted and sentenced to a couple years in jail, or a year and a half or something like that, in prison. And while he was waiting, they find you guilty and then you have to come back later for the trial. So he was out on that and traveling around, and he decided that he wasn't going to go and spend that time in prison. And he went east, and he eventually, he didn't go to Russia right away, but he ended up in, he was in one of those, something like Belarus or so, and he met a woman who is his wife now. So he's married to a woman who's Russian and who's from there, and they're living there. And it's not the best deal for him, because the only work he can get is translation work. Which he does in addition to all the revisionist work he was doing. And then he stopped the revisionism with Mantegna because he wanted to write this book about white genocide in Europe. Uh-huh. And this is the book. And I didn't buy it right away because I kind of forgot about it, and I don't buy books very often anymore. But finally, it came to my attention, and I ordered it. You know, there's something very funny about this book. It's like Barnes Review. It's really wonderful that the Barnes Review publishes things that nobody else will publish, very likely. But at the same time, they often do it kind of strangely. It's like this book was wider than it is now, and it was cut off after all the pages were made, because there's very little margin on the outside edge of the pages, and the cover is clearly cut off on the right margin. But when I got it, I noticed that, and I thought, wow, that's in fact, even the word Volk is not altogether there. part of the K is missing. So I thought,
on your copy it is?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, wow, this is strange. I never saw this before. But then I said, well, it doesn't make any difference. It's all there, and I haven't had a problem with reading it. There's, you know, it's just a little strange why that happened. I wonder why. But
if it was maybe just that run of books, or if it's, I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't have a copy of the book.
They decided to sell them. I bought this through Amazon, and I wouldn't buy it through Amazon, but I, cause I quit using Amazon when they dropped all those revisionist books. But, I wanted to get, the new, German Mein Kampf, side by side German English book by, Thomas Dalton. And I had asked Garamar if he was going to carry it, and he finally got back to me and said, no, the board decided not to do it. So I said, well, I'm just going to order it at Amazon then, because I don't know any place else where it exists, you know. So I'm going to break my vow and order it. So while I ordered that at Amazon, I saw this, and I thought, well, I'm going to order this too.
I see.
So that's the last I'm going to. So anyway, I shouldn't have brought that up, really.
Well, I would just encourage listeners to not only subscribe to the Barnes Review, as I do before every podcast, but also to purchase this book through the Barnes Review. I mean, the Barnes Review.
Yeah, they can.
I'll have a link over to the page on the Barnes Review that you can purchase it. It's going for $35 right now.
I got it cheaper at Amazon, but that's the thing. I would have paid more at Barnes Review, but since I was getting that one, and I was a little irritated, no, I shouldn't have been irritated, but maybe saying, well, if nobody will carry Dalton's Mein Kampf, which I was really looking forward to, I really wanted it from the time I first heard about it, then I'll just have to deal with Amazon.
Right.
So I did.
Well, let's go ahead and jump into the book. It does look great. And as you mentioned, it is, you know, a pretty lengthy book. It's 540 pages, soft cover. Again, I'm looking at the description right here on the Barnes Review. And you know what? Let me actually read the description really quick. Again, it's titled White World Awake, Stopping the Planned Extermination of Our Volk. And here is the description. Western civilization is in desperate peril. White people, our Volk, are in trouble. The question of the day, and very likely the question of the millennium, is whether Europe will survive. And with it, it's American, Canadian, Australian, and South African cousins. And if so, how? Seeking to answer those questions is a very important new book, White World Awake, Stopping the Planned Extermination of Our Volk. Those who seek the truth will find the truth in the pages of this book, and those looking for a practical plan of action will find that as well. For too long, observes the author, white people have fought among themselves. The European Union and NATO are failed efforts to correct that situation. Europe faces an existential threat with tsunamis of unassimilable Africans, Middle Easterners, and Asians swarming in. Russians, Britons, Frenchmen, Germans, and Poles, Serbs and Croats, Romanians, Finns and Greeks, Spaniards and Hungarians are all in the same rickety boat. The time has come for Europe to speak with one nationalist voice on military and foreign policy matters, while it is equally necessary for each nation and ethnic group to preserve its distinctive language and culture, and for historical injustices to be discussed openly. A Eurasian Federation is proposed, which, like old America, will not interfere in other parts of the world except to provide humanitarian aid and ensure the safety of such places as Armenia and Georgia against any immigration threat. Traitor politicians who see no problem in allowing Europe and other white nations to be transformed into mixed-race caliphates, a dream of the mysterious Richard von Kudenhoff-Kalergi, will be voted out of office. Many of the solutions apply equally to the rest of the white world. Close the borders, stop the flood, is key not only for Europe, but America and all other white areas of the world. Thus, Graf lays out a practical 10-step program to stop the genocide of the West, starting with Europe, the cradle of white Western civilization. This is a book that needs and deserves to be in the hands of every concerned person who cares about the future of the Western world. And again, I think we can kind of summarize this book as all about white genocide, who is behind it, and what we need to do.
Well, John, you're reading a publisher's blurb or whatever, and what I got out of reading it is not exactly what they present there. But I will admit that I haven't read every word in it. I skipped a few chapters to go after I read the first six or seven. I thought, well, I got to get back to some of these things that I can't wait on. You know, that sounds so good. I wanted to read those parts. And so I skipped a few here and there. And in the end, there's about three or four that I haven't read, which might have some of that in it. But, you know, what I got was more of what the problem is and how it came about, and a lot of the intricate details of it, which was very interesting to me, but not so much what to do about it, because I was disappointed. I wasn't disappointed because I don't know that anybody knows what to do. You know, he gave the usual things about that. See, this book came out about a year ago, I guess, if not earlier.
Has it been? I was going to say, I think it was even.
I think so.
I think it was only like 6 months ago, I want to say. Maybe it's been longer than that.
Well, you know, it takes a while, and then he wrote it, and he had to finish it and everything. He tried to put in the latest stuff, you know, at the end that was going on, but it's still, because these elections have been going on in Europe, and they looked very promising at that time. The French election, you know, in Germany and in Austria and in other places, but they haven't done so well. You know, things, the right wing parties have gone down, and in Amsterdam, in Holland, they lost. So, things don't look as good as they did when he was writing and finishing this book right at the moment anyway. You know, so, his 10-point plan is, really the usual. There's more in there than that 10 points. There's also a different segments on what he thinks should be done in different areas of life. But this is like if Europe comes under nationalist control again, then this is what we'll do. Well, we all know what that would be. It's like a manifesto, you know. You yourself got involved way back when in writing a manifesto, when everybody did. Everybody wanted to say, this is what we're going to do when we take over. Yeah, well, but taking over is the problem. And so if there's no takeover, that's not going to happen. And so, when I got to that, you know, it was like, well, you know, but what I did find so very interesting was that, he really made the New World Order plan come alive and very real for me. You know, I certainly have been aware of it, and I know what it's, you know, what it's about, but when it's been around for so long and it's talked about, and those words, New World Order, become so, overused, and they're not really overused, but you're just so used to them, it just kind of, falls, it doesn't have the, force in your mind that this is happening. And, here's one point I'd like to make tonight is that what I've thought about this before, and there's so many ways to tie it in, that there's always new information coming out every day. You know, as having a website and following what's going on every day, there's something new. Now it's like, I just started this theme I wanted to concentrate on, stop, special privilege for Jews. You know, I mean, I'm serious about that, and I still want to talk about it later, but I really wanted to concentrate on that. But then I noticed how stuff comes up that one can't really ignore. And every day there's new things happening that are put out there, and you have to react to them, respond to them, or you want to maybe. And you lose track of what you're trying to talk about. Like, what Jürgen Graf is doing in this book is trying to keep the attention on really what the New World Order is all about, how we can fight it. But I don't think he, as I already said, I don't think he did as well with how to fight it as he did with explaining what it's all about. And so, it's hard to keep your attention on that. But when I was reading this book, it just really came back to me so strongly. And it's so horrible. You know, it's really so horrible that it stirs you into wanting to do something about it. And he puts emphasis in the beginning on two men, Jacques Attali, a French Jew, who I could describe a little bit if I'm allowed to. He was born in 1943 in Algiers, a Jewish Frenchman, and he's highly intelligent man, very, very intelligent, a visionary, closely allied with French President François Mitterrand, who, he worked in Mitterrand's government between 1981 and 1995. And of course, Mitterrand was a socialist, and he's naturally, he's even more than a socialist. He also founded a bank, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, that promoted what's, in quotes, noble values of democracy, pluralism, and market economy. Your graph says democracy means you have, right, center, and left parties to choose between. Pluralism means that homosexuals, transvestites, etc., have the same rights as people of normal sexual orientation. And by the way, Graf really dislikes homosexuality and all that sex, that gender stuff that's going on. He particularly dislikes that. He mentions it a lot, and he has a whole chapter on it. And then market economy means you're denied the right to protect your own producers, you know, as a nation from unwanted competition. You know, everything can come across your borders. You can't stop it. So this is what their idea of these noble values are. And, Atali's vision of the future, and they come out with this stuff. They're not hiding it, was one of individual selfishness. Just to put it real briefly, in that people will be just indulging in their whims, his whims or her whims, whatever they, you know, caring about others will not be important, because everyone will do what they want to do for their own happiness and use other people as a tool for their happiness. And of course, rampant consumerism, because there's just nothing there, you know. He says, the pillars of our old society were religion, family, and probably race or nation, you know, national identity. And these are all, gone under this new world order. And then the other person is, Richard Nicholas von Coudenhove Kalergi, who is much better known than Atali. And he was born in 1894 in Tokyo. So the one guy was born in Algiers, although he wasn't, he was a French Jew. And, Kalergi was born in Tokyo, even though he was, his father was an Austro-Hungarian diplomat, and his mother was Japanese. That's where his father met her and married her. And his father was very Philo-Semitic. And then Coudenhove Kalergi himself, when he got older, he married Ida Roland, an actress of Jewish descent, who was 13 years his elder. And in 1925, he wrote this book, Practical Idealism. And in it, human beings of the future will be a hybrid, he foresaw. And the future Eurasian Negroid race will resemble the ancient Egyptians. Jews are the mainstay of intellectual aristocracy. He believed, absolutely, he set Jews up on a pedestal, although he himself wasn't Jewish. Of course, if they had children, they would have been part Jewish. But he said that the superiority of Jews predestines them to become a major factor in any future nobility. He said the persecution of the Jews cleansed them of the weak-willed and the mentally deficient. And that's why they were so superior, you know, over the years of persecution they endured. Anyway, all in all, this is the basis of the New World Order. And Jews are solidly in the ruling class. I mean, this, everything about it, puts Jews almost, in the top positions.
Of course, as like the elite class.
Yeah, but not everybody thinks that, because so many people will say, well, but there's all these whites, you know, and these whites that are up there, Rockefellers or something, or, who are really behind it. And they kind of doubt that the Jews are at the top, but I don't think so. I think the Jews are. I mean, obviously, there's non-Jews there, but I think the Jews are more important. They even make them more important. You know, it's very strange. These people don't think that they're bad or they're good. They think they're advanced. That's the way I see it. They see themselves, and they don't see things in the same terms, you know, like good or bad or moral or whatever. They see themselves that they're advanced, and the rest of us poor slobs are just, stuck in some old ideas that don't work and aren't going to work. And they also see themselves as very practical. They think this is the practical way forward for the globe to work. But of course, it works in a way that they are able to continue to enrich themselves. So it is about money. It's about money, but somehow, Jews, because of of all the wealth that they accumulated are part of that money club, and so they're very big at the head of all this.
Sure. You know, I wanted to go back and talk a little bit about this concept of the New World Order, which you had kind of briefly discussed, and Graf kind of gets in and kind of articulates and explains what the New World Order is. And you're right, it's one of those memes or sayings that you see all the time. Maybe not so much anymore, but I remember when I was really getting, you know, involved in all this, excuse me, and, you know, researching 9/11 and coming across Alex Jones, for example, and also other people, you know, they were always going on about the New World Order and how, you know, the New World Order was taking over America and creating this one world government and all this other stuff. And it was always, I mean, I sort of got like the basic idea of the New World Order, but it was still kind of vague and didn't really make a lot of sense. I didn't understand the, you know, historical or political foundations of it, you know, where it came from, whose ideas are these, what's the ultimate agenda. And I don't think you will understand that until you have a proper understanding of history and a proper understanding of race, because the New World Order, at its very basis, it's about the destruction of, you know, sovereign nation states and national identity, but really only in traditionally white Western European countries. It's all about white genocide, basically. And, oh, Carolyn, are you there?
Oh. Here I am. I was muted my mic, but I don't tend not to do that because it's hard to get it back on again. And it's always sort of takes up more time than it's, but I've got these, people are putting off, fireworks outside. I wondered if you could hear them.
You know, I haven't been able to hear anything really. I've also got a dog barking in the background where I'm at. So I don't know if anybody.
Oh, I don't hear that. No.
Okay. No, you sound
but
okay.
But you know, the thing is you don't hear it, but, my mic is so sensitive that it picks everything up. So it might be on the show, it might not, I don't know. But anyway, I'll just, won't worry about that mute. So I was following you.
Yeah, no, that's really the point that I was trying to make was that the New World Order really, I mean, it is about, you know, this global system, right? But it's also, more importantly, I think about the destruction of the nation state, and even more importantly, the destruction of national identity.
Well, that's how they're going to get the global order, through the destruction of the nation state. That's the most important thing.
Right.
And that's what multiculturalism is for. That's what the migration invasions are for. Mm-hmm. That's what the race mixing is for, to destroy any kind of nation state and national identity, because we, especially of Europeans, really just of Europeans, because we wouldn't go along with it. And they know that. So first they have to destroy us, and then they can set up their global order.
Right.
And they don't they don't do that themselves. You know, they live in a separate existence. And just like we know with the Jews that everything they say that Europeans should do, they don't say Israel should do it, and they don't say that Jews don't do it. They preach the opposite of that.
Exactly, yeah.
With it, you know, I mean, we know that they're doing that, we bring it up, but they still get away with it because enough people who are awake, and that's why Graf says, you know, we need to awake. And that's, I think, after reading this book and, you know, other things, that when we say what we can do, what can we do, there's nothing we can do except get people educated. And we've been talking about educating people forever, you know, since I got into this. We seem not to be gaining very much on that. I guess we have gained some. I guess there's it appears that the internet has done that, but not enough. And I you know, I have my gripes about people on the internet too, to me are not, they're not thinking enough. They're just copying everybody else and they're just repeating things, but they're not really, you know, getting to the real essence of what's wrong and what can be done, and not really changing people. They make a lot of mistakes. A lot of mistakes are made by our people.
Yes, no doubt about that. Well, so getting back to this whole New World Order idea, and I believe it, when we were talking privately or messaging privately, you had kind of explained how he really lays out the history and, you know, the politics behind the whole New World Order agenda. What are some points that he would make? What is the basis of the New World Order? I could name a couple off the top of my head, but I'm curious what you took from his book.
Well, I think you've already said, I don't think there's anything more to it than what these visionaries, European visionaries who are Jewish or very involved with Jews, have determined that the future should be for white countries, you know, so that at bottom, it always comes down to there's a lot to do with trade and free markets and so on. And that way they make a lot of money because they own or control all these companies, these big, what we've always called, what do we call those companies? All of a sudden I forgot, but you know, worldwide companies.
Multinational
companies. Yeah.
Right.
And they do that and they, and the people, once the people become these brown colored, did I say that already? These brown colored, mixed people, they're not going to be intelligent enough. But not only that, they're not going to be, connected to a nation or an idea or a religion or anything like that, that they will fight for and die for and care about. Or that they want to take all that away because then people are just, they're just thinking about what they want temporary, you know, in the moment. Like I say, living by whims and, without any connection to anything deeper. And then they'll all be consumers and they can be controlled. And these people think this is going to be a great world because they tell themselves, I don't know if they believe this, but, that there won't be any war, you know, and nobody will be suffering. Everybody will be reasonably happy because, you know, they won't have any concerns and they'll all be rich. And, it's also meaningless, you know, it's meaningless. And that's the whole point of it. They want to take away how we've always felt our meaning in our lives. They want to take that away.
Yes.
And it's for real. You know, I used to think, John, I guess the difference is that I would think, I wasn't really thinking it through, but it was like, how could people really want that? How could people be that way? I didn't see how people could be so cold and could actually feel that way. They must be, you know, a few insane people or something. But, you know, the thing that all these people that we know, like Bill Clinton, who I used to like, you know, back when, that he was working for this New World Order and didn't care about Americans at all and things like that. How could they be so uncaring? I mean, how could they do that? I swear, it didn't seem like, it just didn't seem real, but somehow all I needed to do was read Jürgen's book here. And the way he put it, like I say, I've always responded to his writing and I always thought he was a good writer. That it did come home to me, you know, that they are this way, whether I can understand it or not, they are. And, because we see the evidence. The evidence is of course more clear now than back in the 90s when Bill Clinton was president or even before that. You could still think that these things were going to work out, but they don't work now. And it's pretty clear. And we see it and they know. So now they're pretty much, they're more honest than they used to be. And, they just say it just has to happen. You know, there's a couple of, while you're commenting on that, I'm going to look up this page here. When I find the page number and read a couple of quotes. In fact, it's
sure.
Right here. I'm on it already.
You know, one thing let me just mention really quick and then go ahead. I want to hear these quotes. is, you know, studying the New World Order and having a better understanding of what it's all about, the history of it, the goals of it, and sort of what you're describing, how, you know, everyone's basically a consumer. No one has any, you know, no one has like a real authentic identity based on race, based on nation, these sorts of things. This is basically the world we live in. So like the New World Order, this like mysterious idea, is actually the world we live in. It's already been institutionalized. And I think it really has been since World War II. It's sort of just increasing in scale, you know, as each year passes.
Well, you're right, John, but there are still people who cling to the old ways, and they're still around, but they want to get rid of all that. You know, they want to get rid of, well, you look at the churches. They're not nothing like they were. They're all for multiracialism. They're all for it. And that doesn't make any sense, but, they are. Well, I was going to read these. Actually, these are not so strange because, people have been, and these European Union, functionaries have been making these statements plain as day for some time about what they're going to do to Europe. But just in 2008, that was quite a while back, President Nicolas Sarkozy, remember that French president who was supposed to be a right winger, he was supposed to be a conservative, he said right in front of a video camera, the goal is to take the challenge of miscegenation, or to accept the challenge of miscegenation. This is not an option. It is a duty. There is no other way. I mean, he said that, you know.
In a speech, you can find it on YouTube. Yeah, I mean, the nerve of this guy. And he's a Hungarian Jew, from what I understand. Isn't his background Hungarian? And
he's well, also, it could be.
Yeah, he's could not even. Be. But, yeah, I mean, that quote is, it's almost one of those things like, wow, he really said that. Like, how could he say that? And no one's outraged. You know, there are people outraged, obviously, but he could just say that, like, in a mainstream, in a speech, and that's what it is. And, you know, that's acceptable to people? Like, that's just insane to me.
Well, right. And when this stuff happens so much and comes along so, so often, we just get used to it. And, it's hard to keep up that idea that, well, I think, there's not that, that we're not, there's no way to organize. I think they're very good at preventing us from doing anything. You know, they're very good at that. They've got it all figured out. I mean, they went about this, as you say, post-war. After World War II was over, they said, okay, we'll start this going now. They already had the idea what they wanted to do. And so they go about it in a methodical way. Look at all these years that they've had to do this and to slowly, it's the frog, put a frog in the cold water and then put the heat on and it slowly boils.
Right. Well, if you look at,
feel it.
I mean, I think really the main attack, the main assault that's advanced this whole New World Order agenda came largely at least in the West, in America and in Britain, it came in the form of cultural Marxism. In my opinion, you know, they basically infiltrated and took over the institutions, the media, and, you know, and this is still ongoing, you know, they're systematically undermining and assaulting traditional Western civilization, all of our moral norms, all of our traditions, they're tearing down our history, rewriting our history. So this is something that was going on prior to World War II, but once Germany was defeated, Germany really was the last adversary to this agenda, right? At least in my opinion, the last organized, efficient, mm-hmm. you know, political entity that was standing up to this and rejecting, not only rejecting it, but exposing and articulating all the lies and just the evil nature behind the whole agenda itself. You know, was really articulating.
Yeah, yeah, he's got a chapter. He's got a chapter on that. Let me go through some of these chapters that, the one I was just talking about was chapter 3 titled The Plan. Then, he's got some more chapters, that, didn't make that big of an impression. I mean, that I didn't include here, but then chapter 7 is the cost of suicide. And that's the one you were just talking about. And something from that I wanted to say was a quote from there. Konrad Adenauer, you know who he is, was pro Coudenhove Kalergi Pan-American Union since 1926 when he was the young mayor of Cologne. And that surprised me. I don't know why I didn't know that, but I had always had a more positive idea of Adenauer, because one time I read in something that I was thought was good, convincing, that it was Adenauer who worked hard to enable the Germans to have their own government again and to run their own government. And it wasn't perfect or anything, but you know, he had to convince the Allies of this, and he became the first new chancellor. And well, it turns out, I'm sure Jürgen Graf is right about this. He knows that history a lot better than I do. And he said that, Adenauer was always pro Coudenhove Kalergi.
Now, just to be clear, Adenauer was the leader of Germany after World War II.
Yeah, the first government, they were allowed Germany to have a government again, and he was elected, I guess, or something, I don't know, the chancellor. And he was in for a long time, and he had a very good reputation. He was a German. You know, he cared about Germany, but yet, he was one of these too. He was I guess he has a history from being mayor of Cologne, that he was into that left-wing stuff.
Right.
And so, I should have known that they would not have allowed a true patriot to head the government, you know, at that time.
Right.
Should have known there was something wrong with him. Anyway, then the next three chapters were about how immigration was used to destroy Germany, destroy Sweden, destroy USA, or one is about the USA. I don't know quite how that worked, but they said it was, the downfall of the USA and Britain. And then chapter 11 is an important one, I thought, one I really wanted to read, The Destructive Principle. And it's all about Jews as the destructive principle. And I think that since I'm thinking about that here, I'll mention it, that, well, because at one point he says, you know, who's behind all this? Who's behind the New World Order? And he starts going up, 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 where we think it's this, it's that, and we go higher. And then he doesn't actually say, but it seems to me to be saying that it's Satan. It's Satan, you know, is the ultimate head of the New World Order. And I thought about that. I thought, well, that means, you know, the destructive principle. That's what I thought before even thinking about chapter 11, that it's the there's a creative principle and a destructive principle. And that's, in Hinduism, in India, they have gods that are just as much worshipped and good, but they're the destructive. They serve the destructive principle because they're equally, you know, you go from one to they balance one another out. And right now we're in the Kali Yuga. So we're going into the very lowest of the destructive principle. And then we'll come to a new golden age and land. And that's the way of, the universe or the world. So that makes a lot of sense to me that, it's the destructive principle at work and, right. And the Jews are representative of that. And, they're in the ascent right now. Then chapter 12 is a big one, the longest chapter, titled The Foundation of the New Order. It's 90 pages long. And of course, this book is illustrated in black and white images, enough of them to make it kind of interesting. And this is about the Holocaust. He calls that the foundation of the new order. And you know, we've both agreed with that, talked about that. And he goes into the entire revisionist argument in these 90 pages, takes you through it all. Of course, I read it because I like to read. Revision, wasn't new to me or anything, but it's, did a good job. And then chapter 13 is his chapter against homosexuality and gender mainstreaming. He has a chapter 14 where he talks about abortion. He also sees abortion as one of the great evils of the New World Order. And chapter 15 is titled The Locust. It's about the bankers. And it's actually written by somebody else, by someone named Thomas Brooks. And he put that in his book. Chapter 16 is titled Battering Ram of the New World Order. And by that, he means the USA and its great military after post-war, you know, post-war. And he mentions Thomas Barnett in the beginning, who was a director at Wall Street, at the Wall Street firm, a Jewish Wall Street firm, Cantor Fitzgerald. You know, that became recognizable name during 9/11. They had some people in their office in the tower that were killed. They had quite a few. But this Thomas Barnett wrote a very famous book. I never heard of it before, but titled The Pentagon's Map. And that's kind of a blueprint for what was going to happen. And he continues along in this chapter with all this stuff. And then he ends it talking about Zbigniew Brzezinski. And you know who he is. He calls Zbigniew a very, very brilliant man who worked for David Rockefeller and President Jimmy Carter. You know, he was Jimmy Carter's advisor, foreign or security advisor or something.
National security advisor.
And the Trilateral Commission. Jimmy Carter was and Brzezinski were big in the Trilateral Commission, Brzezinski wrote this book that's considered quite brilliant and all very revealing, The Grand Chessboard. I didn't read that book. I don't know if you did.
No, I'm familiar with it, but I've never read it.
And it's interesting that this Mika Brzezinski, who's in the news now in her feud with Donald Trump, is his daughter. Is this the big new Brzezinski's daughter?
Oh, wow.
I knew that. And I thought, wow, that's how she got where she is or something. But anyway, then in chapter 17, he devotes to Ukraine. I didn't read that chapter. I will eventually. But there's a few that I skipped because I just had enough of Ukraine. Then chapter 18 is The Henchman, which is very good. It's about the European Union. And that quote I gave and it was from that chapter. And then chapter 19, What to Do. Here we come now. But hope for right-wing parties is what he seemed to be talking about. There's a picture of Marine Le Pen, you know, at the beginning of the chapter. But as I already said, that's not panning out now. So hope for these nationalist parties is getting dimmer. Right at the moment, you know, might change, but that I couldn't find anything more than that in that chapter, and I was a little I don't want to make people think that there's nothing worthwhile in this book, but because there's a lot. But what is the answer? What do we do? Then nobody can come up with anything. So you know, he did the best he could, and then chapter 20. After the storm, which is what a nationalist Europe is going to look like. And that's where he's got those 10 points. And I could go through them, but, you know, they're, if you wanted. And the other things there he describes is kind of like the manifesto of what we're going to have. It all, everything we like, you know. Sure. And then afterward, he has an afterword, and he titled it Coloring the White World. So I guess this was something he added. And I don't really remember what was in that, but you know, there's a picture of that Libyan leader on the front at the beginning of it. Gaddafi,
yeah.
Yeah, and Gaddafi warned us that there was gonna be this mass invasion of Africans to Europe if we did what we were doing. And that's what we're having. But of course, the thing is, that's what they want. This is the thing that people need to know the most. It does get across quite well. It did to me. It got it, and I should already know it, but it convinced me even more. I don't know, more clearly, I would say, more immediately, that everything that's going on has been planned, is wanted, it's not happening by accident or because they don't want to hurt the feelings or they, you know, they feel like we can't turn away refugees or any of this crap they come out with. None of that is true. It's happening because this is the plan for the New World Order. That's the only reason it's happening. And that's why we're not going to stop it by, if we don't understand that and go to the, fight against the bottom line of what's going on. If you just fight against their, what they say, oh, well, you know, the churches, we have to help people and so on. That's a loser because that's not why it's happening.
Right. Yeah, no, yeah. No doubt. There is absolutely an agenda behind all of this. And that's something that I think we actually talked about this last time you were on, or maybe the previous time, how this is a point that I always try to bring up whenever I'm discussing any of these issues. It's like, look, I mean, you may like, you know, immigrants, you may think it's cool, multiculturalism, all this, whatever, but you have to understand that there is an agenda. This did not happen naturally. These people are not naturally in our country. There is a reason they're here. There's an agenda behind it. And it's, you know, again, these people really, they say these things openly, like what they want to do. You mentioned Sarkozy, you know, his quote. There's a million others just like that.
You're right.
You know, where these people,
and I know some of them that I saw just in the past couple of years, just shocked the heck out of me.
Because
they're European Union functionaries that are saying we have to bring all these people into our country. Although they're using the argument that, they're having children and we're not. And you know, this whole thing about Europeans not having children, that was also engineered. It was absolutely engineered and is still being engineered. It's as evil as it comes. And I had a thing I wanted to say on this show that might get this opportunity that I think the word evil is being overused today. And for a while there was something that happened in the news and everybody was going on and on about it being evil. Pundits on TV and so on talking about evil. And it's just overused because there are things that are really evil. Not those things, but this New World Order thing is really, really evil.
You're right. You're absolutely right. It is very evil. It's very diabolical. It's just, it's really incredible once you know, kind of have your head wrapped around it and you kind of have a good understanding of what it's all about. It gets me fired up. It gets me angry. It gets me mad. It's wrong. What's going on? It is truly evil. You're right about that. You know, one point I wanted to emphasize, and again, I have not read the book. It definitely looks like one that's worth purchasing and reading, you know, based on, you know, some of the, you know, your overview of some of the chapters and just, you know, on its description. It sounds like a very worthwhile book, a very all encompassing and, you know, lots of good information. But one thing I will definitely say is that I'm very glad he's making, the fake Holocaust narrative as, you know, instrumental in all of this, instrumental in the whole New World Order agenda, in the white genocide agenda, because to me, that is like one of the most important points to make, is that this fake story that is literally every single day, it is promoted in one way or the other, whether it's, you know, in Hollywood, in mainstream television, on the History Channel, in our schools, a new book comes out perpetuating and reinforcing this fake story. Some quote-unquote Holocaust survivor speaks down at your local library. I mean, I could go on. You know, there's many examples of this. This narrative is absolutely central to everything. And it's easily debunked. It's not, you know, based in reality or truth or anything like that. It's a fraudulent narrative that is used and designed to undermine white identity, to delegitimize white identity. And it's a weaponized narrative. And I'm glad that he's making that clear. This is something that, you know, people on the alt-right really don't emphasize. And I mean, to me, it's absolutely essential.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's of course spent his life and his career in revisionism. He knows it backwards and forwards, so he's translated a whole lot of documents from Russia and so on. So he knows it, and he knows how important it is, and he made it the center of the book and the longest chapter. And I do want to say, too, that even though this book is long, it has big type in it. It's not little tiny type. It's a pretty thick book, but it's not too thick to be held comfortably. But I bet it's like 14-point type in this book, which is unusual.
Yeah, that is pretty big font.
Yeah.
You know, one topic I wanted to bring up, and it's sort of one of these like theoretical conversations or hypothetical conversations that, in my opinion, really aren't all that useful. It's not something I've really spent a lot of time on. And that's like this idea between, you know, like global white nationalism versus like ethnic nationalism. And it's something I know you've kind of talked about in the past, and you've been kind of critical of white nationalism. And it sounds like this is a topic that he kind of gets into and, you know, sort of promotes this idea that whites need to kind of unite and have, you know.
Well, he does. Yes, he does. Yeah. And actually I didn't read that part real carefully. He says, and nobody could really disagree with that whites, being the minority that we now are and in the weak position we're in, we need to all do this together. But I only say that it's very difficult. It's very difficult because, white people have a different interest depending on their nationality and what part of the world they live in and so on. It's, I don't know if that's a strength or a weakness or whatever, but it's in any case, everybody talks about it, but there's not very much of it happening. You know, there are these nationalist parties in Europe and some of them, not the most famous one, not the best known ones, but others that, and they work together from in different, you know, countries, and they work at that, but you don't hear too much. I don't hear too much from them, but I'm not looking for it either. So, I just don't know what to say where that stands or how much success they're having. What it seems like the individual nationalist parties and the big ones, you know, in, National Front in France and AFD, which used to be the other party, in Germany and the Freedom Party in Austria and various other parties in all these countries. They have a party that's doing pretty well, but then they have some other parties. There are other nationalist parties that are more inclined to, that are smaller and more inclined to be working with their cohorts in other countries. But I'm not very big. I'm not really up on that.
I gotcha.
But you can't argue that would be ideal to do that.
Right. To have like a, well, he talks about a Eurasian federation based on the, you know, the description that I read where there's like a common, you know, maybe foreign policy and, you know, military policy, but you know, everything else is kind of left to like each distinct ethnic nation or whatever, which I mean makes sense to me. I don't know. It sounds very theoretical.
It makes sense, but you know,
it seems like we're
work.
A long way from this, from getting to a point.
Well, yeah, because they say, well, we don't want to tell. We want nations to be culturally make their own decisions, and that sounds perfect. But I don't know that if you ever have. It seems like if there's any decisions they can make, you know, on their own, different from one another, somehow that creates arguments and problems. So I just don't know if it's feasible when they talk about a loose union of European nation states. It sounds great. There's so much diversity in Europe between Eastern and Western and Northern and Southern and based on other things too.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, all I can really say is, you know, speaking from a, you know, an American perspective, I'm primarily concerned about America, white people in America, what's going on over here, but I do sympathize with and support, you know, whites around the world. And, you know, I do view it as a broader white struggle.
Sure. But, you know, we really, you're right to think about America because this is where you are and you can't really do what, tell them what to do or follow what they're doing without having any input and then being, you know, frustrated or whatever. So that doesn't work. You have to, I realize that about myself, although, you know, I have this tremendous interest in Germany and Austria, but, I'm here and thank God, I have to say this again, I don't want to, but thank God we have Donald Trump right now for all his faults and failings. At least it's so much better than if we had Hillary Clinton, in the White House and what we'd be dealing with. I mean, I was so depressed. You know, you get so depressed about what's going on, but there's a little bit of better news, you know, now, but
right.
Not that good.
Boy, I'll tell you what,
I'm getting frustrated again.
I think the main thing with Trump, you know, as you said, with all his faults, and there are many, with all his very shady connections and very Jewy connections, despite all of that, I mean, what he's doing with the media to me is very important. It's very good. I mean, just all out assaulting these people and really just exposing them and, you know, look at how they react. It's really interesting what's going on. And I mean, to me, it's discrediting the media, which is long overdue. And I mean, it's something that's
some
different.
Things,
I mean, it's not.
In some things he's got tremendous guts and courage. I mean, to put out these tweets like he does, and I'm telling you, they shock me. I'm not a man, I'm a woman. So I was like, oh no, what has he said? No, what?
Yeah.
You know, and then when the furor starts, I think, oh, he's just derailing his agenda. But then it settles down. And he looks strong you got this fighter there and that's all that you remember is that he's fighting it. And that is good. So this is like something I never would have dreamed of doing what he does with this, with his tweets and stuff and going after the media.
He's real bold. That's for sure.
Yeah.
He does not.
But then
care.
When it comes to the Jews, he's not bold, but you know, there are certain things he does, which nobody else did. And one of them is this, makes me very happy, is this, special envoy for anti-Semitism office in the State Department that Bush approved of and the Congress passed and he signed it and puts this, this office in the State Department. And he said he didn't want to continue that because he was on a cost-cutting mission and that wasn't important and could be cut out. And the Jews started screaming, you know, in their usual way. But he still, the last I know, which is the last there is to know, is that, he just hasn't appointed somebody new to go in there because the other guy's time was up, his term was up, and the office is empty, except for one person who's, temporary employee who's there and now whatever group that's sponsoring him and to be there, they're paying him for one more month. So his time was up in the end of June, but now it's the end of July. So he's still in there doing whatever, but his time is up in July and Trump has not appointed anybody and the Secretary of State, I can't think of his name right now, he says, well, we don't need that. We teach all of our State Department employees to look out for anti-Semitism and what to do and so on. So that works better. But the Jews are not happy. They're not satisfied. They're going to keep working on it. But this, I think, was good for Trump, you know,
right.
Because it's not like it's billions of dollars. You know, it's not like it's a huge, cost savings, but you know, it adds up to quite a few million, and they're running. And you know what they do? I finally looked into this enough. They have a list of every country in the world. This special envoy, every country in the world that the State Department has any dealings with, and they have to make a report every year in which they say how many Jews are in that country, and then any anti-Semitic incidents. And there was one country that had just only a handful of Jews, four or five or something, some little country, and they didn't have any anti-Semitic incidents at all. But there's other countries that have, you know, a whole list of them, and they're dumb things, especially so much of it is graffiti, and they write down everything. Every single little thing and insults to people and people, because these Jews report all this stuff and they have to keep a record of this and they have it in the archives, and it's just so dumb.
It really is. Yeah. It's very revealing. You know, that's the thing, you know, and we can kind of get into this with your article, Stop Special Treatment for Jews. To me, the thing is that they're so brazen. They really are. I mean, again, if you follow the Jewish press and just read and listen to what these Jews say, the way they go around and bully people and intimidate people, and they just operate as if the whole world revolves around them and their feelings and their overall agenda. They really do act like that. And they're just up there demanding and insisting that Trump appoint someone to, you know, for this anti-Semitism envoy, for example, where they're just literally openly demanding and insisting that the U.S. and Europe open their borders to unlimited numbers of refugees. Just the brazenness and the chutzpah. I mean, that's probably the best word for it. These Jews have the nerve of them is just incredible. And that, to me, that fact, knowing that they're just openly doing these things and, again, not making a secret about what their, you know, their anti-white agenda is all about, you know, with anything. I mean, none of this is a secret. And the way that they can just go on and do these things and just get away with it. And no one's outraged. No one's mad about it. No one's calling it out. They're too afraid of being called anti-Semitic or whatever. It's just, I mean, I'm just baffled by it. It's so unacceptable to me as an individual who can think with his brain. It's right. Like, my God, these people are just outrageous.
Well, and that's why, you know, I even mentioned in this article, just say no, bringing back Nancy Reagan, you know, but in this case, you know, when they ask for something, just say no. Why can't we say no? But they're never told no. Well, now Trump is saying no. You know, he's saying, no, I'm not going to do this. He's not arguing with them, but he said he didn't want it. He wanted to get rid of it. And so now he's just not putting anybody in there, and I don't know. You know, the thing is, Congress has purse strings, and they're the ones that say, well, we're going to vote for money for this or that. And then he pretty much has to do it, doesn't he? I don't know how that.
Well, he
hasn't put out his new budget yet, and I think that will not be in the budget.
From what I understand, he does have to appoint somebody. Right now.
Yeah, he appoints. That's right. That's
yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, nobody but him can appoint, you know, can put
that's
somebody
right.
in the office. And from what I understand right now, there's like, you may have just mentioned this a couple minutes ago, how there's, there is currently someone in that position, but
right.
it's scheduled to end at the end of July. And then after that, it's technically unfilled. And of course, you know, like I mentioned, the ADL and all these other, you know, leading Jewish, you know, Jewish leaders.
The special
are demanding.
Not,
what's that?
The special envoy is not in the position. He's gone. It's just some,
it's just some staffer.
Person.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sorry. That's the point I was trying to make, is that there is somebody in the position technically, but it's not somebody appointed by the president. Geez, I totally spaced where I was going.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have interrupted
no,
you.
No. It's okay. That's the point I was trying to make. You want to talk about, you know, emphasizing how Jews have special treatment. Think about this. There is an office in the State Department monitoring quote-unquote anti-Semitism. Talk about special treatment. Where is the office for monitoring, you know, anti-white hatred, which we could easily create some office in the federal government to do this and document these things on a daily basis. But, you know, we just kind of have to rely on people on the internet, people on YouTube to expose these things. But just that's a perfect example is just Look at how these Jews are treated. I mean, they get special treatment for everything. They always get what they want. They're always, their leaders are always testifying in front of Congress, setting the tone of the conversation, setting the parameter of what's permissible political discourse. For example, they control the narrative. At least they have for a very long time. I think their stranglehold on all of this is slowly coming to an end. But I mean, that's the thing. Like it's so obvious.
Well, that's it. You know, they are very aggressive. In their own interests, and they're very well organized. There's so many, as we've mentioned before, so many Jewish organizations just for everything. You know, I'm going to go to something, but you know, there's, somebody just sent an email this evening that, he is in Australia and, you know, just commented that they're cutting back on money for, all these, there's not enough money that we're in debt, you know, we're in $20 trillion in debt in our budget, but there's still money for all these Jewish things. There's still money for all that. And that's what Trump is trying to stop. That's all. And they scream about that. So they know that they're not going to get in any trouble for it. This story just came out. You know, in Australia. And now this is the New World Order at work, because the New World Order is in all over white countries, in operating in them all. And every white country is run by people who are cooperating and completely in the league with New World Order. All of them, all of us. And so here in Australia, they have something called the Community Infrastructure and Cultural Precincts. Which is, that promotes the greater use of community facilities for various multicultural groups. And, five Jewish organizations are among the 30 that receive money. And this year, the Jewish Holocaust Center in Australia is going to get $750,000. Now you see, if you make Holocaust centers, you've got a place to receive money. If you make all these organizations that are, say they're doing this, they're doing that, and doing that for the good of the multicultural world, you've got something to receive money. You have to have something to receive money. I realized some long time ago, really, that if I didn't have a purpose for money, I wasn't going to get any. But I very seldom have had much of a purpose for money, so I don't get any. But that's what you need. You need to have a purpose for it. And they create these purposes. They had the Young Australian Israel Chamber of Commerce Somali Mentoring Program. They're getting $40,000. And the St. Kilda Hebrew Congregation is getting $33,000. And Jewish Museum of Australia is going to get $50,000. So this is all free money. This is taxpayer money that they
just
put aside
subsidizing all of these Jewish
programs.
Well,
and it
shows how they operate literally as parasites. I mean, they just feed off of the government and off of, I mean, sometimes not even the government. I mean, think about like the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in D.C., which Trump wanted to slightly, you know, cut the budget. Just a little tiny bit, a couple million dollars. I mean, they already get like, I can't remember the exact figure, but it's like 60
raised,
million. Yeah.
It was raised up to 54 and, or 54 or 55, and he wanted to bring it back down to 52, which is what it had been the year before. They had just given it a raise, and he says, no, they don't need a raise. You know, we can't afford, we got to just get rid of the raise.
Right.
And you, and then they talk about, oh, they cut, there's such a big cut. Oh, it can't cut. We've got so much to do, so much important work to do.
Exactly. So, I mean, they're not only getting all this money from the government and demanding it and saying, look, you have to give us all this money. It's a moral imperative. It's good for society. You have to give us all this money. And then also, like, I mean, at the museum, for example, you can go around and put in a donation. So, mm-hmm. I mean, they're getting like,
well, I'll tell you that.
They're getting free money from everyone.
Jewish websites are the biggest pushers for donations that of any that you'll find anywhere, you know, and the richer they are, like the American World Jewish Congress, all over their website, they've got so much money, and all over their websites, they've got donate now, donate for this, donate, you know, they push that. They're, this is the way they are, and that's why they are get what they get, because you know, if you don't ask and you don't say you have a purpose for money, you won't get it. That's a universal law. And, we don't do that. We're not money conscious enough. We don't think, well, I gotta get that money. I'll say I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna do that. Because, you know, I've thought about starting a foundation, but I'm too old and I don't want to start a foundation. I don't want to have all that to do, all that work and everything. And I'm not good at delegating. That's probably my biggest problem. I'm not good at delegating. So I don't do anything. But these people, and once they get going, they got a whole networks huge worldwide where they're doing this and they're hauling in the money. They're hauling it in. And you know, I just came across this deal in this New Jersey town where it's half the population is Orthodox, I mean, Hasidic Orthodox Jews. I mean, hardcore Orthodox, horrible looking people. And half the population in that town has become these people. It's how they've, some of the other people living there said they've ruined the town. You know, they're coming there in large numbers, and then they're having 5 to 10 children per couple, and they're all married, and they get married young. And today I just found out, looking for more information about them, that they get child care expenses because the husband, instead of working, is at school in this yeshiva. They have the world's largest yeshiva in that town, Lakewood, New Jersey. And there, it's filled with all these young husbands, and they've already got 2 or 3 kids and no income. So they apply for all this money, you know, from the dependent children and whatever, and they get it. And they're just now, been investigating these people and all the ways they're misusing these agencies. They've been getting millions from these agencies. There's all kinds of these agencies that are handing out stuff to people. And so anytime there's money available, these Jews are all organized to get it for themselves, and they could care less about anybody else. You know, if they're taking somebody else's share who might really need it. And, they say, but you know, some people say, oh, this is going to be really big. And other people say it's not, they're going to get away with it. And, you know, it won't be as big as we'd like. It won't be. And then already the rabbis and the other Jews are saying it's all anti-Semitism attacking these people. And it's really the fault of the agencies because they're not careful enough in checking over the information. It's up to them to find where the Jews are lying, but there's so many Jews in that town. And here's another thing, John, they dominate the school board. One person wrote and said, and they don't put, none of them put their children in school, in the public school. They have, of all their children of these Jews, none of them go to the public school. And, but they're on the school board. They're running the school board, the public school board, and all their children are being in private schools, and they have to pay a lot of money. They're not free. They pay a lot of money, so they need all this help from the government, from the taxpayer. And they think they're They're deserving of that.
They're entitled to it. Yeah, exactly. See, and that's, yes, that's what I mean, like how brazen and just shameless they can be. And we're all angry about it, and most people don't even care. What, sorry, so you were kind of cutting up.
Pointing that out more than you do.
Yeah, I mean, that's really kind of what I try to do is just, hey, look at this Jewish newspaper exposing this, you know. Don't you think we should do something about these Jews, guys? I mean, my goodness.
Yeah, you do that. And you know, but it's like I said in the beginning, there's always something new coming up. So, you know, whatever you're talking about today, it's hard to keep pushing at that because new things come up that seem even worse, or at least they're newer. And so nothing gets done about any of it. It's real hard to
new things come up that just only reinforce and further demonstrate all of the points I've ever made. Not only I've ever made, but, you know, many people have made about Jews.
You're right.
So it's like, you know, just a broken record. We're making the same points about these people over and over and over. And there's all sorts of different examples that we could point to, as you say, on a daily basis. I mean, I try to check my email every day, and I go through and I'm looking at all the headlines from the Times of Israel, from the Jewish Daily Forward. And I'm like, my goodness, I could write 20 blog posts just exposing these people.
That's right.
If I had the time, you know, it's like you can just demonstrate their agenda and just how truly, again, evil they are, how anti-white they are, how, I mean, in many cases, just degenerate and ugly and just gross they are. I mean, they're behind all of these, you know, cultural perversions, whether it's sex or transgenderism or any of this stuff. I mean, literally, they are behind it, and they openly say it and boast about it, you know, in their own publications. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if there's any other points you wanted to make about either the book or your Stop Special Treatment for Jews, you know, this kind of idea. But in my opinion, the best way to really expose the Jews is to demonstrate what they're doing using their own words, using their own sources, and, you know, taking it from there. But again, I think people have such a emotional reaction to this because of all the fake history that they've been brainwashed with in our, you know, educational establishment and by Hollywood.
Well, right. There's several things. As soon as you use the word Jews as a group, you know, well, the Jews this or that, people right away, you know, just normal people, just don't want to look at you funny, you know, well, what are you coming up with? And they don't want to hear it. They think it's already anti-Semitic. And now if it's, but you have to, I'm trying to get at that, that you point out that this is special treatment that Jews get over and over and over again that other people don't get. I think, you know, that could come across to them if you could say, other people don't get this. Just Jews are getting this. And if you could get that through to people, they would say, well, no, that's not right. They shouldn't get what, you know, all this, and other people don't get it. But it's hard to get that through, and how to educate people in that, because I think that's the only way to wake people up, because they're so resistant to any kind of anti-Jewish talk. And that's why if you come out with really, like I could do so easily, and I probably get too much that way, in, even when I'm trying not to, anti-Jewish, then they're gonna turn off. And on the internet, it's, I think a lot of this really, you might say, vile or aggressive, it's not, it's true, but it's real strong language against Jews. It's not going to convince the people who are, need to be convinced. And we don't need to convince one another. We need to reach those people. And it's hard to do when you're talking about Jews and telling the truth about them. But I think, I just still think that by saying, well, this is special treatment for them, and they, I just picked out that special treatment. You can say privilege, but I kind of like special treatment because it is treatment, you know, and
right.
It is special. They're treated differently. And, everybody agrees that special treatment is not fair because we live in this world where where we're supposed to all be equal.
Right. Well, it certainly is special treatment. It's on display on a daily basis. It's very easy to point out. And I mean, I agree with you. It does need to be exposed. And, you know, who knows? I don't know. That's really like the million-dollar question. How do we, we need to like mainstream anti-Semitism. I mean, truly, like, you know, especially considering just, again, how brazen the Jews are and just how, you know, diabolical they really are and how they operate. And it's so crystal clear for people like us that see it. It's just, I don't know. I don't know how people can't see it.
Yeah, like these people in Lakewood, with these arrests of these people coming out, it's having an impact on the white people there. So they're seeing it, and you read the comments from them. They're all against them, and they say a lot of interesting things. They're in the know. A lot of them are very much in the know about Jews, and this gives them a way that they can express it. And not be seen, you know, as they're being unfair. Because what the Jews are these Jews have done there is pretty terrible. And they're taking over, they want to take over that town. And now they call it a Jewish town. And there's a nearby town they're trying to take over. And, I read today that, some Jews said, they had a controversy over the Christmas tree and the menorah last Christmas. And, some townspeople objected to the menorah, and they took the menorah because it was a religious symbol, but the Christmas tree was not a religious symbol. So they did take the menorah down, and they left the Christmas tree up. But then this Jew said, more recently over this new controversy, he said, well, this is a Jewish town, and there is a giant Christmas tree in the square or whatever, and a tiny menorah. And they removed the menorah and left the Christmas tree, but I wasn't going to say anything about it. I wasn't going to say a word about it, he said. So, you know, there's a lot going on. And when they get really bad, you know, like is going on in this town now, then people wake up and people start to see. But you don't want things to get so bad where they're in control, because they're pretty much in control of that town of Lakewood now.
Right. Yeah, I'm going to have to go check out some of like the local articles and read some of the comments of the people. Cause, you know, once you deal with Jews, you kind of see how they operate and see what kind of people they really are. And they can be very nasty, vicious people, no doubt. Very deceptive.
Well, the thing is, they defend their fellow Jews no matter what they do. They defend them. Look, these people have broken the law, clearly, and then they say that those who are criticizing them are doing it because they're anti-Semites and they hate Jews. You know.
Every time, that's their argument.
Yeah, they can't stay away from that. And people don't believe it because they know that's not what's happening there. Yeah, I've got quite a number of links to some of these articles, these local articles.
Interesting.
In New Jersey.
Well, Carolyn, we are about an hour and a half in here. Is there any other points you'd like to make about either topic we've covered today?
Probably not, because I've already broken in and interrupted you enough times during this. I get excited. I get so excited about what's going on, but there's my phone. I think my nephew's calling me, so we better go.
Okay, no worries. Well, Carolyn, thank you very much. It's always great speaking with you. I will have links up to the book and also the article we discussed, and we will have to do this again.
Okay, well, it was great fun. I really appreciate it, Jana. I enjoyed this tonight.
Okay, Carolyn, thank you so much. I will talk to you soon, okay?
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, good night.